I tell you, we've got some very interesting people, and I'm sure they're going to be very, very informative this morning. So let's take a look at the topic this morning. Our topic is how to think about science. Yeah, they caught me off guard this morning. The time snuck up on me. But we are here talking about how to think about science. We have my good friend Lindsey Brooks in studio. He's fired up and ready to go. He has special guests Lindsey Wickman and Seth Stark. And they, too, look like they're fired up and ready to go. So we want to hear from you this morning. Give us a call at 1-888-LA-TALKS. That's 1-888-528-2557 via the Internet at radioatapologetics.com, where we challenge believers to think and thinkers to believe. This is the Apologetics.com radio program here on 99.5 KKLA.
Science is real.
Welcome to the Apologetics.com radio show. My name is Lindsey Brooks, and I am challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe on this lovely Saturday morning. And I am in studio. I am not alone in here. And I have empirical evidence for you that I am not alone here. Introduce a couple of my friends here. Leslie Wickman is here with me today. Now, Leslie Wickman is she's an educator. She's an astronaut. She's a pilot. She's a football player. She's a volleyball player. She's involved in the dialogue between science and theology. I can tell you so many more things about her. Robotics. I can't even begin to give you all that. Matter of fact, let me just introduce her. Ladies and gentlemen, Leslie Wickman.
Yay. Woo. Hey, everybody.
Welcome, Leslie Wickman. I'm so happy to be with you, and I'm so happy to find out that we have common friends. So it's really awesome. Shout out to all my folks in Iowa City out there.
Rah. Woo-hoo.
And Seth Stark of Communion Presbyterian Church, elder, and anybody got a chance to listen last night to our Apologetics.com Legacy and Looking Forward dinner, we did stream that live, and Kevin Lewis said that the elders in your church, they need to be experts. And so we have an elder in the church, Seth Stark, with us tonight. Seth, welcome. Tonight, we're going to talk about science. Science and its limits. What is science? Can a Christian do science? Is there anything that we need to know as Christians about doing science? How about just as people? I'm a dude running around doing my thing every day. I use technology. I have some assumptions about the way that technology works. They seem to tell me that there are certain things that I can't see that are going on in this technology that I'm using. You know, they tell me that we dropped a couple of bombs about 60 years ago on Japan, and they blew up, and that was all because of stuff that we couldn't directly observe, we had to know something about it, and there had to be some kind of knowledge there because it got results, right? Right? Well, it's not really that easy. I wish that it were. I wish I could say that because we can do stuff, that means we have knowledge. But we're going to find out tonight that that's kind of a slippery thing. And you have to be very careful about it. When you are thinking about science, you are thinking about something that has a very special purpose. It is a specialized way of doing something. And we're going to get into that. I'm going to begin tonight, Leslie and Seth, with a definition of science. And it's really the best definition of science I have ever heard. It's by Professor Gabrielle Brooks of Beaumont, California, who is 9 years old. And she said, science is just another way to think about what God has done.
Amen.
She's obviously had a good father teach her these things.
I think that that's maybe the best definition of science I've ever heard.
I like it.
So we can get specific about what that way is, and we definitely are. But I think we should also perhaps explore some other definitions of science while we're at it here. And, you know, Merriam-Webster's and dictionary.com and all of the references that you could possibly think of. Everybody has a definition of science. I'm going to just give you a few. I'm going to begin with, this is what you can find if you just go and you go to dictionary.com and type in science. It says, a branch of knowledge or a study of dealing with a body of facts or truths systematically arranged and showing the operation of general laws. Okay, big stuff here. Let's slow it down. A branch of knowledge. Let's stop there. Science is a branch of knowledge. Can you help us with that, Leslie? Is science a branch of knowledge?
Well, it depends on your definition of knowledge, right?
Bingo.
Yeah. And so if we look at knowledge as information or expertise or skills, then sure.
Okay. Is there... is there a difference between knowledge and truth, do you think?
Absolutely. Truth is much harder to get at than knowledge.
Seth, how would you characterize this difference between truth and knowledge?
Yeah, I would say that truth is something necessary in order to have knowledge, but knowledge... Let me back up. Yet they're not equal to one another, knowledge and truth. Knowledge is something that we can possess as part of truth, if you will.
Can you have knowledge of something that's not true?
That's a deep epistemological question you ask.
Sure. I mean, I don't mean to put you guys on the spot on this particular point because there's a big word for what we're talking about right now, this little part. It's called epistemology. And epistemology is another very slippery subject. But one of the things that we need to address is the fact that the very word science itself comes from a Latin root that means knowledge, right. Scientia. And so at least on the surface, it purports to give us something called knowledge. And at least by this definition, and I have to tell you that this approach of going to the dictionary first to give us a definition of science is really probably about the worst thing we could do. Why? Because the definition of science is a philosophical question.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I would, if we look at knowledge as information, and information is just data, okay? Mm-hmm. You can have data on something from an experiment that you did or a measurement that you took that doesn't have to be necessarily true or the complete picture or the accurate picture. So I would say that, yes, you can have knowledge, if that knowledge is interpreted as information or data, without it being a true reflection of reality. If okay. we say that truth is a true reflection of reality or an accurate reflection of reality, knowledge, i.e. data, doesn't have to be true.
Yeah. It seems like one of the working definitions of knowledge is a justified true belief. A justified true belief. You're familiar with this?
Yeah, sort of the traditional analysis of knowledge in that way, yeah.
Now, there's all kinds of great epistemological things that we come up against with something like a definition of knowledge as well, right? The definition of knowledge is justified true belief runs into certain issues.
Mm-hmm.
Can you be justified in something and have it be true and still be wrong?
Well, again, I think, you know, truth is an accurate reflection of reality, and that's a pretty big order.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let me give you guys a scenario here. It's a classic epistemic issue called the cow in the field. Are you heard of this one before? Oh, good. Good. So let's go with the cow in the field. Man owns a cow. And he wants to know if his cow is in the field. For some reason, maybe his cow keeps getting out or something, wreaking havoc in the neighborhood, tomcatting around. You know how cows are. And so he wants to make sure that the cow is in the field. So he goes to his most reliable farmhand, and he says, would you go and look for me and see if the cow is in the field? And he goes out, and he sees that the cow is in the field, and he goes back and says to the farmer, hey, your cow is in the field. Well, the farmer, trusting the guy to a certain extent, knowing his good character and everything, decides he's going to go and look for himself. And he goes out and he sees something that looks like his cow over by the tree. It's black and white. You say it's a Holstein, right? I'm from Iowa. I know these things. I'm going to get as much Iowa as I can in tonight because I'm just so proud to have a common friend with you. So he, on closer inspection, just as he looks, there's a little flutter in the breeze, and he notices that it kind of moves with the breeze. So he
moves. Is that what you said?
Moves, yes. We're on Punsville tonight. So then he crosses the field and he finds out that it's a black and white sheet of paper that got hung up in the tree that really looked just like the cow. Just like the cow. However, over the hill on the other side of the tree, well, there's the cow. So did the hand have a justified, true belief that the cow was in the field? Was it a justified, true belief? It was justified because he empirically verified what he thought was the cow was in the field. And it was true because the cow actually was in the field. A justified, true belief, right? And he believed it and went back and reported it as if it were truth. And it was true, but was he right? These tricky questions. If we are going to begin to understand science, we have to understand the stakes. This is why we begin with such a crazy exercise of trying to define science by the dictionary to begin with. And then, as you'll see tonight, it's not just our definition of knowledge and truth and what knowledge really is that is going to come under scrutiny here. It's not the only thing that's slippery. Well, in spite of the fact that it's slippery, we still do something called science, don't we, Leslie?
Absolutely.
Okay. I was starting to scare myself there because the more I look at this science thing, the more I go, I start to go like, well, how do I know that everything I know, and it just doesn't seem to be a solid ground. It seems like a shifting sand, and the Bible tells us something about that. So maybe there's a way that we can actually have a science that can tell us a thing or two that we can actually believe is true and have it be right and grow in actual knowledge, right? That's our hope, isn't it? That sure. We really want knowledge.
Right.
Okay. For that, I think we probably ought to go through at least a primer of how science is done, right?
Sure.
The definition of science that we found is lacking. In at least on that very first point, it's kind of lacking. And we could kind of go through each point in it and shed a significant amount of doubt on every single point. Now, I'm not talking about complete deconstruction, right? I'm just talking about, does it really do this thing that's being claimed in the definition? So maybe if we at least start on the other end, instead of beginning with the definition, let's begin with practice.
Okay.
Praxis for the Latin word. I'd love Latin.
Nice.
All right. In the praxis of science, we're doing something. There's something called the scientific method that we're employing.
All right.
Well, what is that, and is it something we can kind of pin down a little bit?
Okay. So the scientific method, I think there is probably a lot of common misconception about what exactly takes place in the scientific method. And so in the scientific method, we use something called inductive reasoning.
Inductive reasoning.
Right? So...
we love big words. What's inductive?
Well, basically, with inductive reasoning, we start from specific observations about nature, phenomena, if you will.
Do, 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 do.
Don't get me started.
Okay, so we begin with observations.
Right, specific observations about nature, okay? Mm-hmm. And from that, we... try to generalize and make larger sweeping statements. And so we observe something, perhaps we observe it repeatedly. And one of the examples that I use with my students is just observing the sunrise, if you will. Mm-hmm. Just imagine you're way back in the caveman era and you're going outside and you notice that the sun...
My wife would say I'm still in the caveman.
But that's beside the point.
Sorry.
So we notice that the sun rises every morning. Okay? And so we repeatedly observe this. It's a very specific observation, but it happens over and over again. And so from that, then we might make a tentative explanation or a hypothesis, basically saying, well, it seems that the sun comes up every morning. Mm-hmm. And from that, we would be able to then make predictions and say, do you want me to go?
That's great. So what you seems like what you're saying is that induction is really saying that a description of something in the past is kind of synonymous with a prediction about what it will do in the future.
Right, exactly.
So in other words, we're saying that the future will be like the past.
We are predicting that based on our past observations and our hypothesis. Okay, so yeah. But as in life in general, we know that making generalizations from specific observations is risky business. Mm. And it might not always play out that way.
Okay.
So
how do we assess that risk? Like, when is something a good risk? Just because it happened a whole lot before in the past, or?
Well, okay, so we have to, with the, again, following the scientific method, we wouldn't stop at just making predictions based on our hypothesis. We would set up tests to test that hypothesis and see whether or not the test results are consistent with the hypothesis. So in the case of the sunrise, okay, you may make a prediction that, okay, the sun's going to come up again tomorrow morning. And we might even narrow it down a little bit more and predict a time.
Okay.
And so then we'd run the test, right? We'd get up the next morning and check and see if the sun does in fact come up at approximately the same time that we had predicted it to. And so we would go through that process and see over time whether or not it was borne out, and do the test results consistently match up with our hypothesis or not.
Okay, so we have another element here of observation. So we have the idea of induction, mm-hmm. which is a presupposition we have that the future will be like the past.
Mm-hmm.
Now, just because the word induction also appears in logic, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to just give us three different kinds of logic, right? There's deductive logic, right? Deductive logic is inescapably true when it's true, and it's inescapably false when it's false, right? So you are literally proving it with deductive logic.
Right.
Okay. In other words, I could say, if Lindsay is a genius, he will know that 2 + 2 = 4. Lindsay is a genius. Therefore, he knows that 2 + 2 = 4. Quote, ergo demonstrandum. It is demonstrated, right?
Right.
It's valid logic that actually literally proves the conclusion. The conclusion necessarily follows from the premises.
Right.
Okay. So that's deductive logic. Now, inductive logic, as we found out, is really about likelihoods.
Mm-hmm.
We're not saying that the sun absolutely will come up tomorrow with inductive logic. We're saying that it's likely. How likely? Well, we have to make some judgments there, don't we?
Right.
Okay. I've got a coin. I have flipped it 9 times and it's come up heads. Now, what is the likelihood that I flip the coin and on the 10th time it's going to come up tails?
Exactly what it was every time you flipped it before.
50-50. Very interesting. So the likelihood of something really doesn't have to do with how many times you did it before in the
past.
So that induction is not necessarily clear in the method, because the method says that you repeat it in order to establish what exactly?
Well, as I like to explain it to my students, okay, the scientific method is not claiming to prove anything.
Big statement there.
Yes.
So when I read in the newspaper, it is now proved that, insert hot button topic here.
Yeah. Science, yeah.
Then that's the newspaper's
misunderstanding.
Lying to me, basically.
It's a misunderstanding of the scientific process.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. So the scientific method, properly applied and properly understood, does not claim to prove anything. And what I tell my students is that we're basically looking for the best explanation or refining that hypothesis given the evidence that we've collected so far.
Okay, so that brings us to the third kind of logic, right? So far we have deductive, which proves it outright. We have inductive, which really talks about probabilities.
Right.
And then we have abductive logic, which is the inference to the best explanation.
Okay.
So, let's take one of my favorite examples of we see that the streets are wet,
mm-hmm.
right? And there are clouds in the sky, and there are drops of water on my car. Now, it appears to be a widespread phenomenon. and so this widespread phenomenon has a best explanation. Now, I could say that, okay, well, my car's wet and the street appears to be wet and my front yard is wet because my sprinklers came on. That's one explanation.
Sure.
But if it's a widespread event, something else probably happened, right? It probably rained. It seems like the best explanation there is that it probably rained. So that's an abductive argument. Inference to the best explanation.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like we're employing a few different kinds of logic here in our scientific method.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would definitely agree with that, that's included in the scientific method. But the scientific method is really not about proving anything. It's really, if anything, it's about falsifying your hypothesis or your theory. It's really not capable of proving anything because you may be collecting more and more data to substantiate your observations. But even if we do the experiment a million times with inductive reasoning, we can't prove that it's going to happen the million and first time.
We are here in studio with Seth Stark and Leslie Wickman. Leslie Wickman is at Azusa Pacific University, and they're having some lectures there at the Chris Science Center that you are the director of.
That's correct, yes.
Who's kicking that off?
Dinesh D'Souza will be kicking that off September 21st.
Dinesh D'Souza, author, apologist, debater, commentator, will be at Azusa Pacific University. When is that going to be?
September 21st, and he's going to be speaking on Defending Christianity for Science, Answering the New Atheism.
Wonderful. We will be back in the next half hour to go a little bit deeper into the scientific method and to hopefully tease out some of these issues, get a little bit deeper in science on the Apologetics.com radio show, where we are challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. We'll be right back.
She blinded me with science.
Are you tired of the darkness in our legal system? Do something about it. This is Don McConnell, Dean of Trinity Law School. God has commissioned us to loose the chains of injustice and set the oppressed free. The knowledge and abilities you'll gain through your studies at Trinity will empower you to fulfill this honorable quest. Trinity is recognized nationally for our commitment to the study of law from an evangelical Christian worldview. Trinity's faculty are rich with real-world experience. Class schedules accommodate the working student, and scholarships are available. Trinity graduates bring integrity to the courtroom, impact public policy, forge victories for international human rights, work for biblical standards in bioethics, and open doors for the gospel. Trinity Law School, forming students to transform the world through Christ. For your free information packet, call 800-922-4748. 800-922-4748. That's 800-922-4748.
Apologetics.com, 99.5 KKLA.
And welcome back. And this is the second half of the hour where we're talking about how to think about science. Lindsay Brooks in studio with his special guest, Leslie Wickman, teacher and astronaut. And Seth Stark is here as well. And he's from our favorite ministry here, Elder. He's an elder at Community Presbyterian Church. We are glad to have you listening as well. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-888-LA-TALKS, 1-888-528-2557. Via the internet at radioatapologetics.com, where we challenge believers to think and thinkers to believe. I'm Curtis Lee, and I got more great music for you. I love this song, so we're going to continue with this one, okay? So keep it right here as we get into our topic this morning.
Welcome back to the Apologetics.com radio show. We are challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. Tonight on the subject of science, what is it? How are we supposed to think about science? Guests in studio tonight are Seth Stark from Communion Presbyterian Church and Leslie Wickman from Azusa Pacific University. And we are trying to suss this out. Last half hour, we kind of got into the scientific method a bit. We're putting the question to each step in the scientific method. What is it supposed to be doing? I'm going to read a little quote here. To put a ruler against a line and say 19 would be altogether unscientific. The scientist does, of course, put a ruler to some sort of line and does read off 19 spaces or whatever it may happen to be, but he never supposes that this is the fact he wants. After he measures the distance between two scratches on a bar of steel, he measures it again. And strange as it may seem, the length has changed. The lump of gold that a moment before weighed about 19 units of the same volume of water now weighs less. When the scientist tries it a third time, the gold seems to have gained weight. That is, the line becomes longer. The experiment is continued until the rigorous demands of science are satisfied, or the patience of the scientist is exhausted. And he finds himself with a list of numbers. Now, it may be a fact, the empirical evidence seems to favor it, that the lump of gold weighed the same way many times is constantly changing. Or the fact may be, not an impossibility, that the scientist's eyes blink so much that he cannot see the same length twice. Or both of these may be facts. Instead of sticking to the facts, the scientist chooses to stick to the fact that he has a list of numbers. Now, is that an accurate description of at least part of the scientific method? Do we
absolutely
measure stuff? And we measure things multiple times.
Absolutely,
right? We want what we call a data set, right?
Right, and we do that over and over again because we know that human error comes into the process. The scientific method is fraught with human error.
Okay, let's explore that in a little more depth, because what we're talking about is empirical observation. This is another step in the scientific method, at least the way I learned it in high school. And,
sure.
You know, I'm beginning to suspect my high school teachers, at least on science. Now, on literature, I got to say, the literature teachers, the music teachers, I have been blessed with an incredible Iowa education.
Well, yeah.
You can shuck corn with the best of them, I'm sure.
I can. I can rogue beans too. The scientific method when it comes to this is called empirical observation. Now, we have to question the empirical observation thing, because we want to see what the issues are there. Mm-hmm. Is Gordon Clark right when he says that we have this weird, mysterious problem that it's really difficult for us to measure the same thing twice and come up with the same number? Is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's largely why we do it over and over and over again, is so that you can get a data set and take the average. And I know then Gordon Clark goes on to say that by taking the average, we may get an average that does not come up with any one of those measurements.
Sure.
And that's very possible, but at least the average is more likely to be closer to the quote-unquote truth.
Why is that?
Well, because if we are dealing with human error or miscalibrated equipment, miscalibrated measuring devices, those errors are thought to kind of average out over a long list of measurements.
Okay, so there's something that we're trying to accept here, right? We're trying to accept that our senses and perceptions are mostly true, only not really true, but mostly true. They're true enough that we're in the ballpark.
Yeah.
And if we measure enough times around the ballpark, we might actually get lucky and get an average that's something like true.
Right. Well, and the other part of the scientific method, too, that comes into play is peer review and repeatability.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want to just do the measurements yourself and call it good, but you want to involve other scientists in the process, or other scientists are encouraged to review your work and repeat the same experiments. So it's not just the one individual that's doing this.
So I measure a line, 100 times or something like that, and come up with a bunch of different measurements, and then I average those out. Which average do I use? Do I use a mean or a median or a mode?
Typically, it would be a mean.
A mean. Yeah. So the mean is what you use. Why do you use a mean instead of the other two?
Because, again, you're just assuming that your errors are going to average out. Okay, so if you're a little bit high one time, you might be a little bit low the next. And not just the human error, but again, depending on what sort of measuring device you're using, you know, it could be that it has an error or variability within it also.
So if you get data from a scientist in Australia and you're going to redo them here in Southern California, and he tells you that he used the mode as his means of establishing, because at least from his perspective, it was an observable, and it's something that showed up in the data set at least, right?
Right, but that doesn't make it more accurate. Okay. You know, I mean, there's no reason to suspect that those numbers that showed up the most frequently were any more correct than the others.
Okay, so we're making a choice of which average to use based on some presuppositions about what human error is like.
True.
Okay.
Again, not just human error, but equipment error as well. So, yeah, the nature of errors or variability in measurement.
Yeah. I think we need a theological opinion on error.
Perfect.
Over here. Sure. Seth, why do humans make mistakes like that?
Well, it's, the easy Sunday school answer is sin.
Okay.
I mean, we're not capable of perfectly interpreting the data that we encounter in nature. It doesn't mean that we can't interpret data. It just means that we're prone to error.
Is there any... If we remove sin from the equation, because that's a theological thing, right?
Yeah,
you
sure.
know, people are like, well, hey, look, sin, really, dude?
Yeah.
If we remove that from the equation, is there an empirical, scientifically provable, reasonable reason why we should be constantly making mistakes?
Empirically provable?
I know.
That's a trick question.
Maybe there. I went too far there.
Well, I mean, if you don't want to talk about sin, then you can talk about the fact that we are finite beings. How's
okay.
that? And that due to our innate human limitations, apart from the idea of sin, we're not capable of having complete or perfect knowledge about a certain object or a certain measurement.
Now, Leslie, did we say this about anything else in nature? Do we say that a star isn't perfectly a star? That you know, or that?
Well, certainly. I mean, we'd certainly say that our senses are not 100% reliable. I mean, the human senses certainly aren't 100% reliable. As far as,
let's take it away from humanity,
okay.
Right? You know, let's apply this to anything else in nature. You know, a quark. Is a quark imperfect in the sense that it, you know, is incapable of doing what it's supposed to do? Or, I mean, okay,
well,
I don't know if quarks are your area. But.
Okay. No, but I mean, even if, you know, this might be a little bit far afield, but when you start talking about the unpredictability at the quantum mechanics level, You know, okay. I mean, we certainly aren't able to, predict what subatomic particles are going to do on a reliable basis.
So there's uncertainty built into at least one area of science, right?
Absolutely.
Well, let me ask at that point, is it built into science, or do we just not have the means yet to detect those laws that govern the quantum level?
That's a great question. That's a great question because prior to what we have learned about quantum mechanics and prior to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, the physical universe was viewed as a very mechanistic entity. And very mechanistic, very deterministic. And with the advent of of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and quantum mechanics, quantum fluctuations, the kind of immediate reaction to that was, oh my gosh, you know, now we're living in an indeterminate universe. And what does that do to our worldview? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to think about that because some people would say that, a mechanistic universe rules out God's intervention, whereas others would say that in an indeterminate universe where we have quantum fluctuations, that provides a place for God to work. And others would say that vis-a-vis the mechanistic view and the deterministic view, well, if it's a mechanism, then God is the divine machinist or mechanic. So it's kind of interesting because you can kind of fit your worldview to either one of those perspectives. But, you know, it does occur to us, you know, well, maybe it only seems indeterminate because we don't understand the quantum fluctuations, and we just say, though, that it's completely random because we don't know enough. But maybe down the road we will discover that there is some predictability to that.
Yeah. So it seems to me that we're brushing up against a kind of difficulty with observation. We'll just call it the problem of observation. Okay, just for lack of a better term. There's a problem there. And so we have to make some assumptions about this problem. And as we make these assumptions, which themselves are unproved, right? We say that we have the presumption that our errors are going to average out, but there's no guarantee.
Right.
So we could even... By what we showed earlier, we could even show that our wrong observations come up with right and useful purposes, right? It serves our purposes in a useful way.
Right.
Wrong observations can still be useful.
Right.
And in fact are.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, by and large, even though our measurements in science may come up somewhat off, you know, not exactly on the mark or completely accurate. The data, even if it's you know close, is very useful in you know progressing in science. And I mean, I like your daughter's definition of science. I mean. As far as you know, a general definition, I would say it's a tool for learning about the physical world and how it works. As a Christian, I would say that it's a tool that we use for uncovering how God did things. And in fact, as a Christian in science, I would even take it a step further and say that science, as a Christian, I see science as a means of worshiping God and learning how he did things. And it's more of, as we discover how God works in creation, it's a source of awe and worship for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that exact sentiment has been echoed by Christian scientists, philosophers, theologians throughout history. I mean, the more we learn about nature, the more we ought to be in awe of our Creator.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me go back to my high school scientific method chart here. And let's kind of go down. One is, it says, to begin with, we ask a question, and then we do background research. Then we construct a hypothesis, and then we test the hypothesis by doing an experiment. Then we analyze the data and draw a conclusion, and then we report our results. That's the scientific method that I grew up with. Is this commonly the method that's employed by scientists out there, or is there a greater variety and flexibility in what the method is that might be tied to each individual discipline even?
Well, by and large, that's pretty much the way it works. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty standard as far as how it's applied and followed. I mean, it's pretty well agreed upon within the scientific community, and there may be subtle differences in terms of how each step is performed, but by and large, it sticks to that same framework.
Okay, so would you say then that the psychologist who is trying to determine what a particular behavior might be caused by some...
You would pick psychology. That's pseudoscience.
We're gonna get mail from psychologists now.
I know. Sorry. Peace.
So, sociology.
Those are all fuzzy sciences.
You know you're talking to a physicist, so anything other than physics is pseudoscience.
Okay.
I'm a rocket scientist.
Okay. Let's go with cosmology then.
Okay. But actually, I mean, the fact that you brought up psychology, I mean, it is a very interesting example because we're not necessarily dealing with what we... commonly think of when we talk about the physical universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a little bit of a difference there just in terms of what we commonly perceive as what is involved in the physical universe. And
but psychologists think of themselves as scientists?
Oh, absolutely. They do. But I have friends in the psychology department at APU who would willingly concede that it is a much more fuzzy science than, biology, chemistry, physics. Hmm. So, I think it depends on your worldview again, as to whether you think that mental processes and human thoughts and feelings, for crying out loud, are all just physical impulses? Are they can you reduce mental processes completely to the electrical impulses in the brain? I mean, that's a very reductionistic or materialistic viewpoint, but, some people practicing that field would take it to that level. So then it is...
Sure. I think that's Daniel Dennett's...
It does then fit within the quote-unquote, physical universe. I'm not a psychologist, so I can't really speak to, a more Christian view of psychology, but I would venture to say that it's not as reductionistic or materialistic in terms of understanding thought processes.
Okay.
So,
With our scientific method from you know, a school textbook that I have here, and I'm trying to compare to what I've learned from you, a college professor in science. We've talked about induction. We've talked about data that comes from empirical knowledge that we get through sense perception. And it seems like we have to build into our scientific method more than what's here, as a nutshell. We have to build in some kind of safeguards, some kind of protection against some of the problems here. And everything, it seems, in this process has a problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right, it's a human endeavor. Right? Every human endeavor has error built in and, you know, problems, imperfections. Anything that's pursued as a human endeavor is going to have errors and problems.
So we've got all these issues with science and its ability to tell us truth and knowledge, and yet I fly on airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And my Mac works.
Right. So even, again, you know, even if our measurements of observations aren't exactly right on the money and can't, because of that, be considered quote-unquote truth, they're still close enough to be useful by and large, you know, especially when science moves from pure science to applied science and technology, that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. And it better be close enough, or your plane isn't going to stay in the air.
Okay,
your Mac's not going to work.
It seems like there's at least what we might call a pragmatic test for science.
Right.
In, like, does it work?
Is it good enough?
So, one of the things, let me go, I got a quote to read. Can you believe that? I actually have a quote or two here. After all efforts to find a way to obtain reliable knowledge, scientific method, or the scientific method, has been found superior to all other methods. That's from www.scientificmethod.com. I'll give you one more, and then I'll take your comment on it. The other methods discussed are all inflexible. That is, none of them can admit that it will lead us into error. Hence, none of them can make provision for correcting its own results. What is called scientific method differs radically from these by encouraging and developing the utmost possible doubt. The utmost possible doubt. So that is what is left after. So that is what is left after such doubt is always supported by the best available evidence. As new evidence and new doubts arise, it is the essence of the scientific method to incorporate them and to make them an integral part of the body of knowledge so far attained. Its method then makes science progressive because it's never too certain about its results.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that.
So isn't that another way of saying what you said before, though? Which is, it kind of never gives us verified truth,
exactly. I mean, I would not say that the scientific method is good at establishing truth. It gives us perhaps the best explanation that we have given the evidence that we have so far, but it at the same time does encourage the skeptics to throw stones and to move forward from there. I mean, we've got all kinds of examples in history of that happening.
And we're going to talk about history on the other side of the apologetics.com radio show. We've gone through the first hour just trying to lay some groundwork. What is science? How is it working now? And on the other side, we're going to talk about some of the history involved. Who said what about it in the past? How did it work? What about that Galileo thing? Didn't we Christians just step in a big mud pie with that Galileo thing? Or not? Maybe all is not what it seems. So, we are challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe on the Apologetics.com radio show about science, and we'll see you on the other side of the break. Welcome back to the Apologetics.com radio show. My name is Lindsay Brooks. I am challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe on this lovely Saturday morning on the subject of science. What is it? What is science? Just seems like there's so much animosity between science and religion going on, right? I mean, there've been a few court cases. Some judges have even had the hubris to define science for us. And of course, you know it's true when it comes from a judge. No offense, I'm sure there's some great judges out there doing good work, and none of them are defining science for us. We're trying to get our head around it. We have eminently qualified people here in the studio, PhD in, what's your PhD in?
Well, it's in mechanical engineering, biomechanics, and human factors specifically.
And you are a professor at?
Azusa Pacific University.
By the way, this is Leslie Wickman. For those of you who are just tuning in, we're talking with Leslie Wickman from Azusa Pacific University.
Good morning, everybody.
Tell us some more about what's going on over there at APU.
Okay. Well, I direct the Center for Research in Science, and one of the more visible things to the public that we do is we run a Science, Faith, and Culture lecture series throughout the year. And this year, we're going to be doing a series on defending the faith in the light of the challenges of the postmodern era. And Dinesh D'Souza will be kicking off our series on September 21st, and he's going to be talking about defending Christianity for science, answering the new atheism. So again, that's September 21st at APU. Check out our website at apu.edu/CRIS.
CRIS stands for?
Center for Research in Science.
Center for Research in Science at Azusa Pacific University. Check it out. You are the director of that?
That's correct.
Wonderful. I hear that you're writing a book.
Well,
not like you have any life experience or anything.
I know.
I'm really impressed with your resume for sure, and I'm sure that the book will blow us away. Tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, well, I just recently set up my website at leslieannwickman.com, so go check that out. I'm trying to do more speaking engagements on topics in science and faith, and you can find some of the topics that I cover at the website. It's kind of my hope that I've been thinking about writing my autobiography for quite a while now, and it's kind of my hope that my website will enable me to start doing some more blogging. I've got a lot of notes I've collected, but I want to try to organize that more into some blog entries, and so I'll be dealing with both my life story. And then I've got another book project that I've been kind of incubating for a while on reflections on science and faith.
Wonderful. Now, one last thing. You played football?
Yeah.
So, like, like on the Rams or?
Was the...
Like the Pittsburgh, I mean, Steelers when you're... Pittsburgh, or I mean,
no, like, the California Quake women's professional football team, and yeah.
Now this is like American football,
absolutely
crashing into each other at full speed. None of this trying to run around the field
kicking
with a ball,
soccer ball. No, it's
no offense to Kent Morlock and the fine
love
team
soccer
that he's rooting for.
Go Netherlands.
Go Netherlands.
All right. Yes.
I told my daughter to go up to Kent Morlock and say, go Spain, just to see what happened.
But no, yes, this is NFL rules. Yeah. Full tackle, pads, helmets, all the whole nine yards, so to speak.
Leslie Whitman rocks. And also in studio with me is Seth Stark from Communion Presbyterian Church. Elder there, yes?
Yeah.
And what's going on with you? You're doing a course of study right now on this very subject, are you not?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I am one semester away from being done with a master's degree at Biola University in the topic of science and religion.
Wow, and,
awesome.
Yeah, it's a really good program. I've enjoyed it greatly, and they do a good job out there at Biola. And I assure you that any deficiencies in my thinking that come across tonight are not the fault of Biola.
Okay. Well, that's a ringing endorsement. And some of your professors over there are?
Well, let's see. Dr. John Bloom.
Yes.
Who I know Dr. Wickman knows. Let's see.
In fact, Dr. Bloom has come and spoken at our Chris Lecture Series in the past on the Anthropic Principle.
Oh, wonderful. So, yeah.
As has our own Christopher Nyswanger.
That's absolutely right.
Wonderful. Yeah. Let's see. Paul Nelson. He's a great guy who I've taken courses from at Biola. He's involved with the Discovery Institute and the Intelligent Design community. And Bruce Gordon would be another person from that community that's taught classes at Biola that I've got opportunities to study under. So some good folks, some really smart people out there that make me realize how much I don't know.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As does present company with me. But let's see if we can... And we can bring this back. And first thing I want to also mention that my goal here today is not to just beat up on the scientific method and beat up on our view of knowledge or anything like that. I just want to see what it is, you know. I want to see what it is so that we can say, well, you know, does our worldview account for it? Does our worldview allow it?
Absolutely.
And does our worldview allow it to actually do something instead of just be kind of a mishmash? So in order to get to that point, I've got another hurdle for us to cross, and then I want to really get into, well, you know, what are we saying about science? What has Christianity been saying about science in, say, the last 25 years? Like, there's a few views that we've got to cover, right? We've got to talk about... the answers in Genesis guys, and we got to talk about the reasons to believe guys, friends of ours, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to talk about the Discovery Institute, and we got to talk about BioLogos.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all of these views that sort of fall under Christian, the Christian rubric, and they have different views of science and how it's done, what it is, what it means.
Right.
Okay, so we've got to get to that, but before that, we got to get one more hurdle done. So, what I'd like to do is we're going to back up just a little bit. We got to go back into time a little bit here. We're going to talk about science in history. Now, you've done some thinking about this, right?
Yep.
The big names, right, are all most of them are like gone now, right? Einstein's not
Galileo,
around.
Yeah, Galileo's been gone for a while.
Francis Bacon, you know. Somebody said that he's alive and well and living in Venice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Along with Elvis, right?
Exactly. But these are names that even if you are just barely doing life, right? You're out there and you drive a truck for a living, bless you, because we couldn't run with that. You got to know some of these names, don't you? Mm-hmm. You got to know Francis Bacon.
Yeah.
You know, who is this Francis Bacon guy?
Francis Bacon rocks.
didn't he come up with kind of the first systemized idea of doing science, right?
Well, there are a number of people that were credited with developing the scientific method. One of the things that Francis Bacon, though, is really big in my book on is the two books model of creation and revelation, and that you know, God being the author of two books, the book of his words and the book of his works. You know, the book of his words obviously being scripture, and the book of works being creation.
Now that's that's consistent with good Protestant theology, right? I mean, special revelation and you've general, got general
exactly,
revelation, right?
Exactly, yeah. And Paul talking about how the truth about God can be seen in his creation.
Now, one of the issues with the Francis Bacon's view of science, just as an outline here, I'm going to read from Del Ratch's Science and Its Limits, and this is Del Ratch's view of Baconian concept of science. He says, the early view of modern science came from Francis Bacon. According to the Baconian view, scientists begin by collecting observational data in some purely objective manner, free of all prejudices and the topic being investigated. Having no prior preferences concerning what theory should be correct and not hampered in any surreptitious philosophical or religious presuppositions. They then organize their data in some naturally perspicuous way, again, without any smuggled presuppositions or constraints. Then by a process known as induction, the correct generalizations and explanatory principles emerged out of the organized data. In some cases, more than one possible explanation might emerge, and then additional data could be collected and settle the issue in favor of just one of the possible explanatory principles. But at no point did presuppositions, philosophical predispositions, religious principles, or any subjective constraints enter in.
Wow, that's a pretty high view.
I was going to say, if only it was that easy, right?
Yeah, and so purely practiced.
Yeah.
Do we ever, Seth, come to anything just purely as it is? Or does everything for us have some kind of presuppositional baggage and religious baggage and all that?
Yeah, I mean, every person is going to bring their set of beliefs to bear on whatever fact they're encountering. Absolutely, and I mean, I think the scientific method can help to clarify some of those things, but we've got to be careful even then that we don't bring our presuppositions, if you want to use that word, into our science.
But we do bring presuppositions into science, and we discovered that in the last half hour, didn't we? That we have to bring some presuppositions in, or we can't do science, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We gotta presuppose, you know, induction. We gotta presuppose that our measurements aren't cool, and we gotta figure out how to, you know, have a way to make them cool. So we have to have some presuppositions about ourselves.
It's very hard to take our worldview glasses off when we do anything. You know, we all come with a way of looking at quote-unquote reality.
And it's not even really desirable to do so. At least we don't think so anymore. This Baconian view is almost, I mean, it's kind of an ideal that we have, we still have a residue of it in our thinking, but it's not really what we think is the right or good way anymore, right? We think of it in terms now of, well, of course we bring ourselves to the equation. As a matter of fact, quantum physics, as you mentioned before, has shown that the observer is always mm-hmm. part of our science.
Right. Right. Well, I think there's some important things to think about when we talk about the worldview that we bring to science. For example, I mean, we have to have a worldview that believes in the physical world.
Yeah.
In the reality of the physical world.
Absolutely. And when you think about the birth of Christianity in that first century AD, that's something unique. I shouldn't say unique. That's not necessarily unique to Christianity, but the cultures that it's encountering don't always accept that
right.
as a presupposition, that just the fact that nature is real and that it's not an illusion.
Right, exactly.
That's something that Christianity says, no, we can affirm the reality of nature.
Right.
And it's absolutely something that has to be there if you want to study nature.
Right, and coupled with that, the Christian belief that God, the Creator, is separate from His creation, and therefore it's legitimate for us to investigate His creation.
Right. You're not going to be offending some god of the forest or god of the stream if you go out and measure the diameter of a tree or exactly. the rate of water passing through a channel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and also we can rely that the future will be like the past because we have a God who has said, I do not change. Mm-hmm. And he's laid out a plan. He's told us what the end's going to look like, and it's not going on right now. And as long as things go on the way they are, in other words, the end is not here, they're going to be, yesterday's going to be like today.
Right. And I mean, yeah. And two, and you know, Paul talks in Romans about the truth about God being revealed in his creation, and that God's attributes are reflected in his creation too, in terms of that consistency and the sustaining power of God in creation.
Right.
So, yeah, I think those are all key points.
Well, and there's a lot of other stuff too, right? Like the laws of logic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can't really get the laws of logic just from physical things bouncing off one another, can we?
No, I don't think so at all.
I don't think so either.
No. Yeah.
So, one of the things that we think is that God thinks logically.
Yeah, God's right. a rational God, absolutely.
And if a rational God made the universe, and the rational God made our mind to be rational, mm-hmm. and a rational God made our senses to live in the universe, and to know some things about him through what he's made...
Mm-hmm.
Then we have reason to believe that what we perceive is
right.
real.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some theological presuppositions that you've just listed off that are absolutely necessary for the scientific enterprise. You know, the theological presupposition that God is a rational God and that we're made in the image of God, that's something very unique to Christianity, that mm-hmm. mankind is created in the image of God. And a lot of the old pagan religions, if anyone was made in the image of God, it would have been the emperor or, you know, the king or whoever mm-hmm. was ruling at the time, but certainly not every single human. And so you can see how that would limit any sort of investigation of nature right there because, right. you know, of course, the slave or the peasant doesn't have the rational faculty necessary to do whatever it is that this science thing is because only... Caesar is made in the image of God, right? Caesar is God, not anyone else.
Right. Now, we don't really have another way to substantiate the laws of logic because we can't do it by logic, right?
Right.
Right. Right. It's sort of it's a transcendental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's something that we rely on being true. I mean, at least the big three things in logic, right? The law of identity, the law of non-contradiction, and the law of excluded middle. Mm-hmm. At least those three we want to hold on to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right?
Except
yeah.
maybe some quantum physicists want to get rid of the law of excluded middle. But, you know, let's hold on to at least those three. There's a lot more to logic. And certainly there's a lot more to being a logician, in other words, being the kind of person who thinks about what logic is and mm-hmm. what it comes from and what its proper object is. We know that that's a deep well.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go with, you know, common sense view of logic, Aristotelian logic, mm-hmm. right? The big three, I call it, mm-hmm. all right? Those things, if those things aren't true, we can't do science.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about some other stuff that we can't, you know, we certainly can't prove by the scientific method, but we have to hold them as true.
Right. right? Well, I mean, actually, I think one of the really key things is, you know, even coming from a naturalist perspective, a pure materialism worldview, you still have to rely on the consistency and order in nature and the fact that... these observed laws of nature are consistent, and otherwise you'd be dealing with utter chaos,
yeah.
and you wouldn't have any repeatability. You wouldn't even expect things to behave the same same twice in a row. And so even coming from a purely materialistic perspective, in order to do science, you have to believe in an orderly creation or orderly universe.
What about some other things that are required in our thinking to do science?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've talked about we've talked about God being rational and we being made in the image of God so that we also have that rationality. But I think that Christianity contributes even more to that. We have a positive command to investigate nature. You know, the biblical language is that we have dominion over creation. You know, we're supposed to be stewards of God's creation. Right. And that's seen as a not just a you have the ability to investigate creation, but you have a duty to investigate creation as well. And that's another unique thing about Christianity. It's the idea that man has this dominion over creation as opposed to being one with creation or trying to become one with nature as a lot of pagan religions espoused.
Right. Well, and there's, I can't remember where this is, if it's in the Psalms that says, taste and see that the Lord is good. And then there's a place in, is it Thessalonians, I think, that says, test everything, hold on to the good. So, you know, both the Old and New Testament were encouraged to engage with God and God's creation.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
You know, not be afraid to test it and to look into it and investigate.
Yeah.
So before we go on, I'm sure you've got lots more for me, Seth. We've got Greg from Costa Mesa. Curtis, can you put Greg on with us? Greg, you're on with Apologetics.com, and you've got a question for Dr. Wickman.
Yes, I do. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Thanks for taking the call. Let's see. The last time I remember Dr. Wickman being on with you guys was probably a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And you were discussing anthropic principles.
Right.
I do have a question about anthropic principles, but it kind of gives light to what you're just talking about concerning logic, etc. One of the principles I remember you talking about was the mass of the Earth and how it was just the right balance, just the right mass such that it would allow the abundance of ammonia to escape,
right?
Yet keep the water molecule.
Exactly. A good memory.
Well, I have a geology background.
So. Oh, okay.
Anyway, about a year ago, I picked up, I believe, an astronomy magazine. Unfortunately, I don't have it in front of me. And they were discussing, new planets that are being observed, which could possibly have life.
Mm-hmm.
Yet all these planets, they considered to be like super-Earths and have... sizes and masses 8, 9, 10, 12 times the size of our Earth. And I thought, okay, how does that work?
Right. So what's your question? Sorry.
The question is, why are they even thinking about supersized Earth?
Right. Earth? Well, one of the things that they're probably looking at, I mean, you know, as we have discovered more and more exoplanets, planets around other stars, you know, when we first started discovering them, the only ones that we were discovering them were these supermassive ones that were Jupiter-sized and beyond, simply because they're so far away that those were the easiest to discover. As time has gone on and as this new spacecraft, the Kepler mission, which you may be familiar with, has given us more technology to discover these exoplanets. We've been able to see smaller and smaller ones, but the significance of there are a couple of things that they're looking for. They're looking for ones that are closer to the mass of the Earth. And then they're also looking for ones that are the correct distance away from the star, so that they're in the habitable zone. So you're right. You know, if the mass is not low enough, if the mass is not comparable to the Earth's mass, then they are going to have exactly those same problems that we talked about with the anthropic principle and the correct types of gases that can be held in the atmosphere. You're right. If it's got more gravity than the Earth does, then you're going to be holding on. The planet's going to be retaining a lot of ammonia and methane, which are both deadly, obviously. So yeah, that's definitely a problem. You know, it's not to say that we won't find something that is similar to the size of the Earth. It's at a similar distance. And that those will be interesting, you know, kind of theological questions, I think, more than anything to kind of think about is, you know, what is the significance? What if we did find another Earth out there? What if we found another habitable planet? And what if there is intelligent life on it? You know, what are the theological implications? I think at that point it becomes more of a theological discussion.
Yeah, which brings me to a really quick follow-up question, if I may.
Okay, go ahead.
I forget the name of the gentleman, but I think he's an astrophysicist. I'm not even sure. I believe he's an astrophysicist up in Washington who's written a book about, from my understanding, I haven't read the book, but it has a lot to do with anthropic principles. He's an atheist. But through his studies, he's come to believe that we are in a unique situation. Earth is a unique planet.
Uh-huh. There's actually a couple of people that come to mind that have kind of made those statements. Brian Greene's Elegant Universe, does that ring a bell?
I think that may be him.
Yeah, and then there's the Discovery Institute people who put out Privileged Planet. And both of those, but the Privileged Planet people are definitely theistic. Yeah. So, but yeah, there certainly have been those observations that, there's an awful lot of things. I mean, you know, way far and above, just those two that I just mentioned in terms of the mass of the planet, giving it the gravity and the distance from the sun. There are so many other things that are necessary for life. So just, even if we found a planet that met those two criteria, we'd still be a long ways from having a habitable planet.
Greg, thanks for your call. Really appreciate it. We're coming up on a break here. On the other side of the break, we're going to get a little more deeply into what Christians have said. Hopefully bring folks up on a couple of big philosophy of science names. We got to talk about Popper, Karl Popper. I keep wanting to say John Popper, but isn't he the harmonica player from Blues Traveler?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. No, Karl Popper. We got to talk about Thomas Kuhn and W.B. O'Quine and other guys like that. And we definitely have to talk about, you know, Hugh Ross and, you know, a bunch of other really cool folks. So, this is the Apologetics.com radio show. We're talking about science, and we'll get back to you on the other side of the break.
Apologetics.com, 99.5 KKLA.
And welcome back. Last and final segment of the show, and we are happy that you decided to stay up with us and hang out with us for a little while. We're talking about science with Leslie Wickman and Seth Stark. Lindsay Brooks leading the panel this morning. Glad to have you once again. Now, if you want to get in on this last segment, you need to call us at 1-888-LA-TALKS, 1-888-528-2557, via the internet at radio@apologetics.com. Challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. This is the Apologetics.com radio program.
Things we all know, fighting off the disease, programming
Welcome back to the Apologetics.com radio show. Rocking a little science by System of a Down. Science has failed the world, they say. You know, science is for, has neglected faith, is what the lyric says. Kind of a sharp thing they're saying.
Yeah, a lot of people think that today, too.
I think we've outlined a little bit in the last half hour that you got to have faith in a bunch of stuff mm-hmm. before you can begin to do science. Mm-hmm. And then once it almost seems like once you have the bare minimum to do science, then you kind of cut off, right? And then faith no longer becomes anything like a species of knowledge. Hmm. And becomes more like, unicorns and teapots and crazy stuff like that. So let's begin with a whacked out question to get our minds moving again, and then we'll get back in here. The whacked out question is there a difference between science and invention?
Hmm.
Let's begin with you.
Okay. Doctor. All right. So... I mean, I think you can, what do they say, that necessity is the mother of invention? Mm. So, sure, yeah, you can invent things without quote-unquote science. We're using science in a pretty specific way now where we're talking about the conventional scientific method, right? So yeah, I think you can definitely invent things just because you need something, right?
Sure. Science is more than just trial and error, right?
Right.
Exactly. We're not saying that trial and error equals science. As
exactly.
a matter of fact, we're saying exactly the opposite. Trial and error might be part of a robust science, but it's certainly not science.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely not the whole picture.
Yeah. So... I think with that question answered, we're starting to knock on the door of some of the philosophy that has gone on in the last century and a half, probably. Baconian style science ain't what we use anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't think about things as being completely presuppositionless. We don't. Some of what Francis Bacon said we still hold on to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Methodological things and certain presuppositional things mm-hmm. about the orderliness of the universe and all that we talked about in the last half hour.
Mm-hmm.
But Einstein was a guy who said that even if all the predictions of his theories turned out according to his predictions, that he would still say that his theories weren't true, and that they were maybe only a little bit more true than Newtonian ideas. That's a pretty heavy, statement from the biggest brain of the last 100 years,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So, why does he say this? He says this, we've come across this idea. One of the key things in Baconian science is the verification idea. And this comes also through logical positivism. Logical positivism is this idea that we begin with sense data. And then we extrapolate from sense data that the... Here, let me grab the book, actually, because it was put really beautifully in the Baconian concept here. The correct generalizations and explanatory principles emerge out of the organized data. Right? Does that happen?
Well, it happens to a remarkable extent. I mean, I'm very kind of reluctant to pay lip service to this whole idea of verification because that word is just so misunderstood. When we talk about verification in science, it's not as if we're verifying a true theory, something that is no longer really a theory, but truth. It's we're saying that our results are consistent with our hypothesis or our theory, but we're not putting a stamp of approval and, you know, set in stone that, you know, yea, verily, this is now true. It's not that sort of a verification.
So it's a little bit of an equivocation there that I want to make sure that we clear up.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about this dude, Karl Popper, that we mentioned at the end of the break. Karl Popper said that this whole idea is kind of wrongheaded. It's upside down.
Mm-hmm.
We really go the other way around.
Right.
We come up with a hypothesis, an idea first, and then we come to the data. And we try to falsify, not verify.
Right.
And in fact, Popper's whole thing is that verification can never get you anything like knowledge. And at least if you falsify stuff, then you know what the case isn't.
Right, exactly. And really, I mean, that's the way the scientific method is designed, to falsify rather than verify. I mean, again, we're checking out our hypothesis, we're checking out our theory, but we're never going to prove it with the scientific method. We're going to accumulate evidence that is in concert with our hypothesis or not, but we're not going to prove it. Again, it's an accumulation of evidence, so it's adding to our case, adding to the weight of our case, adding to the weight of the evidence, but we're never going to prove it with that, but we certainly can disprove our hypothesis or our theory.
Then another big brain on this whole philosophy of science has come, and he said he coined the term paradigms, right?
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
always hear this in car commercials, right? It's a paradigm shift. Well, that actually means something, right? A paradigm is a huge, big, broad idea mm-hmm. of science.
Right, or kind of a model of the way we think about something.
Sure. I think big stuff, like the atomic theory of matter
mm-hmm.
or the germ theory of disease, right? Big stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as long as you're working within the paradigm, first off, the paradigm is not something you're going to just discover on your own. Paradigm is something you're going to be taught.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As long as you're working within that paradigm, then you're doing good science. And paradigms inevitably begin to break down.
Mm-hmm.
They start having what you call anomalies. Now, a few anomalies are sort of expected, and you figure out, well, we just don't know how to figure that one out yet. We'll get to it. It'll fit into the theory eventually by some discovery. You get a few more anomalies, people start going, this is a real head scratcher. And then you get a bunch of anomalies and you have what's called a crisis
mm-hmm.
in the paradigm.
Right.
And a new paradigm must emerge that accounts for the anomalies in the old paradigm.
Right.
And now you have a new paradigm and the cycle begins.
Right.
And now if you're in the new paradigm and you're doing that kind of science, you're doing good science.
Mm-hmm.
And the old paradigm is not good science anymore. Now, off the top of my head, it seems kind of relativistic, right? Is science a social construct?
Well, I mean, any human endeavor is, to some extent at least. And, I mean, I think, you know, one good way to understand what we're talking about is to use an example. And so if we talk about back in the days of Galileo,
mm-hmm.
the previous paradigm was the geocentric view of the cosmos with the Earth at the center.
Sure, the Ptolemaic universe.
Right, the Ptolemaic universe. And so, so Galileo started making these observations that did not go along with geocentric view, as had others before him.
Copernicus,
yeah. And anyway, so, you know, he came up with these anomalous observations, which, in fact, Ptolemy himself had come up with anomalous observations, which is why he had come up with these little epicycles that the planets had to go through, as well as the orbits themselves. So, I mean, his system, he knew it wasn't perfect, and so did all the others that followed after him between himself and Copernicus.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's a process of discovering. It's like, well, this, you're right, this doesn't quite fit. But, you know, where do we leap? Where do we go from here?
Here's a question. Was there anomalies in Galileo's?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. Galileo, you know, didn't have the concept of the elliptical orbits.
Sure. Now, mm-hmm. now did, was there observational evidence to support Galileo's view at the time, during Galileo's lifetime?
Absolutely. Right. Okay. So
was there sufficient, amount to say that, that Galileo's new paradigm was the right one?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he had, multiple pieces of evidence that, the geocentric view was incorrect. I mean, he looked at the phases of Venus, for example, and, showed that the phases that we could observe of Venus were only, understandable if both Venus and the Earth were, orbiting the Sun. You wouldn't get the observations of the specific phases of Venus if Venus was orbiting the Earth instead of the Sun.
Okay, so we have some observations that...
I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. He had a whole list of things. I mean, there were a variety of them, so yeah.
So we have some observations that seem to support a heliocentric universe,
solar system
that moves around the Sun.
Right.
Right. Now, Seth, this has been an area of your study as well, right?
Sure.
So what's going on with that Galileo thing? First off, this is an area where the church gets kicked around on a lot. Are we justifiably kicked around on the whole Galileo issue?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because we take it so out of context.
Absolutely.
And we say, here's Galileo being the champion of science, and here's this oppressive church trying to keep down this truth because it somehow conflicts with their theology at the time, right? That's the typical picture that's painted of this whole situation. And I don't think that's fair.
I agree.
To either side, really. Galileo certainly did not view it in that way. Galileo, you know, he never recanted his faith. He died a good Roman Catholic.
Right.
He certainly had a difference of opinion with other Catholics, but it's interesting to note that before he had published his heliocentric views, back in 1611, he was like the rock star of astronomy in his day, and all these Jesuit astronomers loved Galileo because he had invented the telescope.
Right.
He had been able to see stars that no one else had ever seen before.
Right.
And he had this celebrity status amongst Roman Catholic astronomers, people that later on would disagree with him strongly. In addition to that, at the time that Galileo was coming up with his theories, the Protestant Reformation is going on in Europe, and the Pope is losing all kinds of political influence, especially in Northern Europe. And so when somebody comes along like Galileo and challenges something that is considered an established doctrine that is challenging not just the authority of doctrine but the authority of the Pope, the Pope's already losing so much authority in all these other areas. You don't want to let Protestantism in through the back door of astronomy, and so we've got to stop this. And so there's a deep history there that's really overlooked a lot.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the important points to remember too is that this geocentric thing wasn't just coming from the church. It was basically the Aristotelian worldview that the whole culture had bought into.
Yeah, absolutely. It was predominant for, you know, a couple of millennia.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it's certainly not something that you just look at the Bible and you get this idea.
Right.
It's a philosophy that was brought into the church,
right,
in a large part through people like Thomas Aquinas. He helped to bring in a lot of Aristotelian philosophy into the church in the Middle Ages. And I don't know that the church really had much of a problem with with Galileo's science. It was the challenging of this Aristotelian philosophy that was the big deal. Yeah.
Hmm. I find this fascinating. Actually, your back and forth on this is perfect, because I think one of the things that I constantly hear as an apologist is, well, you know, Galileo is a perfect example of Sorry, my Mac died and I had to plug it. So all my notes are gone. So I'm going to have to fly by the seat of my pants here. That this whole Galileo thing was just proof of how religion just makes everything bad. When really what we're seeing is kind of a paradigm shift in action and the way things look during a paradigm shift.
Yeah, and you have to remember, too, that Galileo wasn't the first to publish these heliocentric ideas. That was Copernicus, over 100 years earlier, before the Protestant Reformation had come onto the scene. Copernicus publishes, I believe it was in 1492. I think it was the same year that Columbus sailed.
I can't remember the exact year, but I do know that it was basically when he was on his deathbed.
Exactly.
He didn't want to fight that battle himself.
Well, and what happens to Copernicus? He publishes, or this book is published on his deathbed. You know, they don't do the Wycliffe thing of unearthing his body and burning it and spreading the ashes in the Thames River. You know, that's what the standard thing to do with really bad heretics was. And that's not what happens to Copernicus. He dies peacefully, a good Catholic deacon or officiate in the Roman Catholic Church there in Poland. And his ideas are not really looked down on. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, this is an alternative explanation. And at the time of Copernicus, there really wasn't the observational data to support it. That came later with people like Galileo and others. But the heliocentrism really isn't the issue.
Right.
It's this philosophy that comes along with it, in addition to the history or the political changes that are happening in Europe at the time of Galileo, as opposed to Copernicus.
So what we're kind of learning tonight is that science is not a big monolithic thing that we think it is.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different things that have happened through history that we've called science and were good science. And there's different things in different disciplines now that are even good science that may not necessarily fly in other disciplines. That none of the presuppositions that are required for science can be provided by naturalism. Those presuppositions have to be imported and assumed based on a worldview that can actually support them, like Christianity. Now, now, what do we Christians do with science? We've got the guys at Answers in Genesis, right? Those are the young earth creationists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing science based on a young earth creation model, young earth presuppositions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got our friends at Reasons to Believe, right? Who've been on our show several times. What's their position?
They would be classified as an old earth creation or progressive creation position, taking the day age position on Genesis 1, where you have long creative periods.
So you have a young earth creation and science being done in that paradigm, and you have an old earth creation and the science being done in that paradigm at Reasons to Believe. And then just kind of moving along this scale here, right? Then you have the theistic evolutionists like Francis Collins, who was the head of the Human Genome Project and is now – isn't he like the –
head of NIH.
Yeah, National Institutes of Health.
Yeah.
And he started something called the Biologos Society, and Biologos is theistic evolution. So why do you want to take a crack at theistic evolution?
Well, yeah, sure, I can. I mean, basically, theistic evolution is the belief that that God ordains and sustains the process of evolution, and that God used the process of evolution to create all the different species.
Mm-hmm. And this seems to be maybe a little more respectable in academia, right?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Not a lot of young earth creationist scientists going on at, you know, major universities, right?
Yeah. I mean, This is an area where it's like, I mean, there are various positions on this spectrum, as you've pointed out, and I guess I think one of the important things for us as Christians to remember is that, by and large, the theology that we share across those positions is the same. Mm. And not to use those different positions as dividing points, but just kind of different ways of understanding how God created. We're all in the same boat with, you know, God created. You know, God created the heavens and the earth. God created everything within the heavens and the earth and called it good. And so I think it's very important for us to remember that, rather than trying to, you know, draw lines in the sand and divide ourselves among those positions.
Yeah. You have some comments there?
Well, you know, I've had some interesting discussions in my classes at Biola. I'm a young earth person. And I've had some good conversations with students and professors out there. And I think a lot of them are surprised when I tell them, I still call you a brother or a sister in Christ. I think maybe young earth people have a bad reputation in that they stake everything on the young earth position. Hey, if you believe the earth is older than 10,000 years, you're going to hell.
You know, I've heard that.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the reputation we have. And while I don't think that's true, as a young earth person, I would say that there are some hermeneutical issues that are raised by old earth or theistic evolution positions. But that might be betraying some of my presuppositions, where I think that the age of creation is more a theological issue than a scientific issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's kind of my comment on it is, yeah, we are definitely brothers and sisters in Christ. No question about that, as mm-hmm. long as you affirm the basic tenets of the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are some big issues that distinguish young earthers from old earthers from theistic evolutionists that they don't have to stop us from worshiping God together, but they shouldn't be brushed under the rug either. That would be my summary of the position. They need to be hashed out.
Okay. I think it's very interesting and educational to discuss the various positions.
Yeah.
And again, you know, one of the things that I like about science is, you know, we're trying to uncover the mysteries of how God created.
Yeah.
And
I think that we should definitely, you know, do maybe another show to talk really more specifically about the Christian views of science and what's being done. Would you come back for that?
I'd love that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, you betcha.
Wonderful. You know, we'll let you get through that last semester, too. I know it's an awful lot of work to finish that master's. So let's see. We got just a couple of minutes here. I want to, as fast as we can, answer a question from Ron in West Hills. Ron, you're on the air with apologetics.com. Hello, Ron. Okay. Guess we don't have Ron on the air. Sorry, Ron. You know, feel free to call back next week, or you can email me with your question at lindsay@apologetics.com. I apologize for not getting to you there. So the great Augustine had spoken about that it would be foolish of us. I don't have the quote in front of me because my computer turned off. The great Augustine had a quote, something to the effect of, look, if clear knowledge contradicts your hermeneutic of Scripture, then you have to reassess your hermeneutic, because you would be foolish to take something that's clearly knowable and then to interpret it according to your hermeneutic of the Bible in such a way that you make yourself to be a fool.
Yeah.
Now, I wish he said it so much better. But
he did fine.
We kind of need to balance that against the fact that when we say that the Bible is true, that's what we mean. We really do mean that the Bible is true, and that there is a way of reading the Bible that is consistent from beginning to end, mm-hmm. and that our science must be done within the light given us. What is knowledge was the question that we began with, mm-hmm. as we started to mess around with the definition of science. What's knowledge? Well, one thing that we Christians have to believe is knowledge is God's revelation, his self-revelation in Scripture. It must be knowledge and must be sure knowledge by definition because it is infallible. When God speaks, it is definitely true. God cannot lie and God is omniscient. So when he speaks to us clearly in propositional sentences in the Bible, we have to accept that it's true. Now, our hermeneutic is another issue. Are we reading it well? Are we reading it right? Are we reading it in such a way that we're not messing up what's been given to us? That's another question, and that's something that we're open to. That's maybe the difference between our young earth and old earth perspectives, right? A young earth perspective begins with Scripture, reading it in a certain hermeneutic. Old earth creationists actually begin with our sense experience like scientists and then bring that to the Scripture. And understanding one another in this perspective is crucial. But the reason why we spent 2 hours talking to you about science is so that you can be demystified. Science is not what we think it is. It's not this monolithic, perfect path to knowledge. It just is not. Almost every scientific theory that has come along in the past has been debunked. It is no longer valid. There's a new view of what is true and what is real that's given to us by science. And guess what? It will be debunked. Mm-hmm. I promise you that much. That has been the pattern. We will never come to this idea that we had at the end of the 19th century that we've almost got it worked out except for tinkering. That is not what it's about. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Leslie Wickman.
Thank you.
And Elder Seth Stark. Thank you both for being here.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Apologetics.com radio show. We're challenging believers to think and thinkers to believe. And we will see you next week.